Is it April Fool's?
I'm going to call this meeting to order.
I just sent by Frank.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Climate and Energy Committee to order. We have a quorum. Chair Akin will be joining us a bit later. But to start out, we have the minutes from February 28th. Representative Davis, if you had a chance to look at them.
Yes, so moved, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion on the to approve the minutes.
Okay. Representative Davis moves that the minutes from February 28th are approved. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
And the motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
Holy cow.
Okay. We have a first bill is Representative Lislegard. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lislegard. I will move HF 2011 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, and please tell us about your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My note says Madam Chair, but I see that that's not the case, is it? So, but no, thank you so much. I'm excited. You're going to hear two bills today that I wholeheartedly believe in.
Oh.
Good job not bringing that up.
I'm fine.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
Representative Lislegard.
I hope that she's all right. So, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2011 with you today. This bill is requesting $25 million. Of state investment that will support an upgrade in Minnesota Power's high voltage direct current transmission line connecting North Dakota with Minnesota, which greatly increases the capacity, creating bidirectional flow capability and decreasing transmission congestion. This is a major economic development project for our region. This is a bill of a one-time appropriation which strengthens Minnesota Power's federal application and its bid to bring federal IIJA dollars to our region. The upgrade to this transmission line will increase its current capacity of 550 megawatts to 900 megawatts. If the state and federal investments are successful, Minnesota Power will be able to increase capacity to 1,500 megawatts. And eventually 3,000 megawatts. This is a really big deal regarding reliability within our state. This bill also assists the state in reaching its goal of 100% by 2040. You know, it's going to relieve congestion, allowing additional renewable energy resources to flow to our state. Obviously, if you see behind me that I have a number of experts, and those are my written remarks, but I want to tell you that the people that you're going to hear from today, that I trust them. You know, you do the right thing the right way, and you put together a plan that is going to enhance people's lives. And, you know, not everybody on this committee agrees with 100% by 2040. But the state of Minnesota made that determination, and we move forward. And what this bill is going to do, it's going to put us in a position to be leaders by investing in the future. And that's Zach Stevens, and I like him too. So when you're going to hear from the testifiers, you know, they're the experts. They're going to be able to break down the bill and what it does. Ask them the questions that you really do have. I think it's important because this is the type of bill that moves our state forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to my testifiers.
Great. Thank you, Representative Lislegard. We've got your first testifiers there. Would you please welcome to the committee? Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Pierce, and I'm the Vice President of Strategy and Planning for Minnesota Power. It's great to see you all again. I work with Minnesota Power, and we're so excited and want to thank Representative Lislegard for bringing forward this bill. We are really here today to support an innovative and differentiated transmission project that is truly at a historic juncture in its life. First, how it's differentiated is that there's only a few long distance high voltage direct current lines in the entire nation. Minnesota Power is currently the proud owner of one of them. It spans 465 miles between northern Minnesota and central North Dakota. It's a very unique system that has served the region and this state well since 1977 by providing stable and efficient power for the transfer of energy in the upper Midwest. As a critical piece of infrastructure, it is now time to modernize this aging system. The technology is ready for update, and we need to position it for the future needs as we continue to advance our journey to a carbon-free future. Second of all, our grid in the upper Midwest is undergoing tremendous change, and we are in need of additional transmission to help manage the new energy flow patterns as more variable generation comes online, reduce congestion, and maintain a reliable electric system. MISO and our regional planning entities have repeatedly identified the growing needs, and there is much to do, and it takes a long time to do each project. One of the ways we can do this transition right is to, and most cost effectively, is to find options that leverage existing infrastructure to do more for us versus building all brand new. With our proposed HVDC modernization project, we have a once in a 40-year opportunity to design this system to be ready for the future. Today's technology, it is really advanced since 1977 and can be augmented with the ability to efficiently increase our capability on this system in multiple phases. The additionality will help bridge not only near-term upgrade benefit that will happen immediately with 40%, moving the power capability of this line from 550 megawatts to 900, but also if we are successful in earning the state and federal support, it will position the system to be ready for future upgrade to 1500 or beyond. The proposed configuration that we are designing now will provide us the ultimate flexibility and maximize that grid. The innovative modernization project will enhance operations as well. This ability to be bidirectional, on command, will help meet the reliability needs and be grid supporting for the state and the region. This project is low impact to landowners, with less than a handful of landowners impacted in Minnesota and similar in North Dakota. Our project is requesting funding from the DOE for the Energy Grid Resilience Program because this line and this upgrade to the system will help grid resilience. We are checking all the boxes for the federal grid, and with your state support, we will be able to strengthen our request to bring federal IIJA dollars here back to Minnesota to help our customers. The federal attention on national grid infrastructure is growing. Our electric system needs additional opportunity, and we need additional investment to support these impactful infrastructure projects. This system will be truly meaningful addition to Minnesota. With the investment mentioned in modern electric infrastructure, jobs, and the communities in northern Minnesota, we're proud to be the operator of this unique system and position it for the future with your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier I have is Kevin Pranis. Welcome to the committee, and would you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Chair, committee members. Kevin Pranis on behalf of LIUNA, Minnesota, North Dakota. As the committee members know, we represent 29,000 skilled construction laborers and family members who work on building civil and energy infrastructure projects. And as you know, we're strong supporters of building the kind of infrastructure that we need for the 21st century. And the single biggest obstacle that we have right now to doing that and to assuring future affordability and reliability of electricity is a lack of transmission. And we've seen that that lack of transmission for Minnesota has cost our members hundreds of potential jobs on mostly wind and solar projects in especially the southern part of the state, but all over. It's also deprived us of opportunities to bring more cost-effective energy to customers. And so using this asset is of tremendous value, I think, both for job creation, also in terms of delivering reliable energy. HVDC lines, as I have learned, I did not know starting this, but are especially valuable resource because they move the electricity much more efficiently than AC lines, which means that you can move a huge amount of energy from one place to another, limiting your losses and making it cost effective and adding new resources onto the line. And so if we don't have a lot of HVDC lines, we have two that I'm aware of that serve Minnesota customers. This is a huge asset that could be made significantly more valuable through this project. And initially, our support for the project was just based on bringing in new energy and being able to create new wind and solar jobs on the other end of that line. But it also turns out that HVDC is a big opportunity for building trades members. You need facilities on both ends of that line to convert that power, and we're looking at 150 jobs, sort of like high-quality union jobs in North Dakota and 150 in northeastern Minnesota in order to build out that infrastructure that, as pointed out, is capable of eventually serving up to 3,000 megawatts, and you're talking about at least one job for every megawatt additional in terms of generation on top of the jobs in the HVDC line. So it's a great deal. There's lots of federal money available. We'd like to make sure Minnesota gets our share, and we would ask the committee to support this so we can reach our goals.
Thank you. Next testifier we have is Annie Harala. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Lislegard for authoring this. My name is Annie Harala. I'm the First District St. Louis County Commissioner from Duluth. My support for this funding request comes from a deep commitment to see more clean energy coming to our county and living wage jobs to build and maintain this infrastructure. I'm asking you today to support the citizens of St. Louis County and Northern Minnesota in gaining access to reliable clean energy for our homes, communities, and businesses that help to meet those 2040 clean energy standards. Our county has made specific and historic investments to our buildings and properties to utilize clean energy infrastructure. This project pairs well with these investments, and they help us to collectively prioritize our citizens' goals in addressing climate change. This is an investment also in economic development so that we can ensure our large power users as well as our neighbors that we all can have consistent and reliable energy access as coal is phased out. Thank you for this committee's leadership, as well as to Minnesota Power for their commitment to clean energy. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have on my list of testifiers, unless there is someone else from the public that wishes to testify. Seeing none, we'll move to member questions. First, I have Representative Altendorf.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lislegard. I have a few questions. So in your testimony, you said that this transmission line is necessary to bring in the electricity needed to flow into our state. Is that correct?
Representative Lislegard.
Mr. Chair, what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to the professionals.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So this upgrade to the line will actually allow the power to flow both ways. It can come into our state. It can go out of our state. It can help stabilize it when the state needs power in either direction.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So specifically, you know, you said we have a 2040 clean energy plan, right? Mm-hmm. That's what everybody has agreed on, or that's what was rammed through the legislative session here, was this 2040 green energy. So my question is North Dakota a complete carbon-free energy that we're flowing back and forth?
Mr. Chair, I'll address before I turn it over to Julie here. When you say ram down, you know, I've been here for 4 years, and I've seen this go through the process maybe, you know, vary a little bit. Mm-hmm. The same people testified for it, and the same people testified against it. So it went through the process multiple times, and whether you agree, you think, industry was going to go there by 2050, I will grant you that. But the state of Minnesota decided to move forward with 2040 with off-ramps to protect certain industries. That's why I think it's important. And I'll let Julie testify, but at the end of the day, no, nothing was rammed down. Last 4 years I've been here, this type of conversation was moving forward, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So in terms of the energy mix on the line and how it will be utilized, so right now today, Minnesota Power uses the line to transfer over 700 megawatts of wind energy from North Dakota that is produced in North Dakota to our customers here. It is a very critical part of our renewable energy plan, and we are currently 50% renewable for our customers. This line infrastructure has helped us get there. We purchased this line in 2009. We invested in 700 plus megawatts of energy in North Dakota, clean energy, and that energy has been flowing this way. In the future, that line will be able to continue to bring that energy from North Dakota, which a lot of that energy is clean, and will be able to stabilize the system in the real time as it's needed.
Thank you. My question wasn't answered.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. My question was not answered. Is North Dakota completely going to be carbon-free energy by 2040 as we're using this transmission line and the energy is going back and forth?
Well, Representative Altendorf, I'll say that, you know, we don't have someone here from North Dakota, but their stated plans is that I know right now. I don't know of those, although I know that their governor is very interested in getting to carbon-free energy.
Okay.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again for the answer. I guess, so my question is, you know, to you and to everyone, is we are shutting down viable coal plants in Minnesota, and basically we are trading that energy if we can't meet our electric demands here on green energy. We will be getting energy from other states who are not completely carbon-free. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lisbegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So we're hooked up to the MISO grid, and the MISO grid is a very expansive system. And I would say that there is all sources of energy on there, including coal. And I see as the country transitions, you know, out of it, but I do think that they're still going to be on there. This line, I guess I'm not the individual that's going to say what they're doing in North Dakota and beyond, but I can tell you where the country is headed, right? And so we know that this is, whether we like it or not, we're transitioning. And some people would much rather have it go slower and some people faster. The state of Minnesota has settled on 100% by 2040, and now we are putting in the pieces to make this successful in our state.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I know we've passed a 2040 energy plan. I understand that. I think the Minnesota citizens would have appreciated that we flipped this, that we figured out the way to get there before we regulated or mandated something that's not going to be achievable by 2040.
Representatives, I just will want to comment, Representative Altendorf, perhaps not all the Minnesota citizens. Representative Splinski.
Mr. Chair, are you going to be editorializing all committee hearing like that or just with Representative Altendorf? I just want to know so I know what my proper role is in the committee today.
Representative Garofalo, appreciate the comment. Thank you.
Could you answer the question?
Representative Garofalo, I'll make comments as I feel they're appropriate. Representative Swinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the testifiers, so you're asking state taxpayers to come up with $25 million. How much is North Dakota going to be coming up with as far as this project's concerned? Are they also going to be pursuing monies?
Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, great question. Yes, we are looking for support from both states. North Dakota is currently in process of appropriating $25 million to support the federal funding application and demonstrate the support that the state has for this infrastructure project.
President Suski.
Yep, thank you. That's good to hear. Roughly, what's the split when it comes to how many miles of transmission lines that are in Minnesota versus in North Dakota of that 470 miles?
Chair, Representative, I'd actually have to check. I think it's pretty close to even. I'd have to check. I'll get back to you on that.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just kind of, you know, you talked as far as a total investment, my understanding that it will get the matching funds up to $50 million for each state if we're approved, both Minnesota taxpayers and then the printed money from the federal government. And then it's my understanding there's going to be a couple hundred million dollars of investment on top of this by the ratepayers in this territory as well?
Yeah, so this, Chair, Representative, yes, this is an energy infrastructure project, so whatever funding that is not able to be brought in from state and federal sources will be worked through the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission process and to the customers of Minnesota Power.
Thank you. Representative. Mr. Chair, thank you. And just kind of in general, I know it's been spoken that there's going to be also potential upgrades. I believe it's 750, and their goal is to get to 1,500. Of capacity. Will there also be, you know, potential? There's a lot of talk internationally with the threat of potential nuclear war in any EMP. Will there be the upgrades in those particular areas to protect this grid infrastructure from like EMP potential pulse or whatnot as far as that upgrade? I know it's been discussed within those subcircles. So.
Ms. Pierce?
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So this technology is state of the art. This is, when you walk into it, it kind of looks like a space station. It's that advanced. And so, yes, it will be designed to the latest electrical infrastructure standards and probably above and beyond, because this infrastructure has to last. And so we do design to the highest standards and meet all required electrical standards and system standards. We also have the capability to add to the system later as needed. So it's very, you know, like all energy infrastructure. And as utilities, we need to keep modernizing our system and upgrades as new things come available.
Thank you. Just appreciate your time and your answer to the questions. You're doing a good job. Just to kind of, you know, just to kind of finalize it, what is the potential upgrading as far as what's going to be invested in North Dakota when it comes to this project? So obviously there's going to be other tie-ins along the way, but also, you know, the coal plant, that's going to still play a piece of the transmission and the pull in from that part of the state. What is the, you know, is it going to be a solar mix, a wind mix? What is your perceptions out there? Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Chair, Representative. I guess I'll start with just foundation that this system will be connected to the broader MISO grid, right? So it will be connected to substations in both North Dakota and Minnesota. It will actually have identical stations that convert the energy from AC to DC on both ends, so mirror images of each other. So the investment that is going to happen for this project will be exactly the same on each side, because it needs to be in order to make this system work. So that's a very good thing. After it's interconnected and it's connected to the broader MISO grid, this upgrade will enable Minnesota Power. This first upgrade to 900 megawatts is going to help enable Minnesota Power to meet its long-term goals for energy supply. And so we are positioning this line with our integrated resource plan that was recently approved by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to continue our journey from 50% renewable energy up to 80% and beyond by 2035. So we see this additional transfer capability that will be available, along with the expandable capability for the future that we can consider, very important to meeting our power supply goals in our current integrated resource plan. You know, what will be on each end, I can't speak to that quite yet. Each state, each end has very interesting and different geographies, and so that will still yet to be played out. But we see it playing a very critical infrastructure role.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Pierce, project size, total project size, about $700 million, is that correct?
Ms. Pierce?
Thank you, Chair, Representative. We are currently in the early design phases of this line, and we are obviously working on what the final design will be. So the early estimates earlier this year, and we're currently still working with OEMs, it was approximately around $700 million, as you've seen in the handout. We are, you know, obviously subject to everything that's happening in the world, so that number can change, and we have a lot to play out before this line actually comes into service. But it is a significant investment, as was mentioned by the other testifiers, for northern Minnesota and for the state of Minnesota.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could ask. Thank you. Ms. Pierce, so my understanding, obviously there's lots of reasons to do this, but one of the reasons why is that this is simply deferred maintenance and modernizing of our infrastructure, that that these costs are going to be borne either way. So the question for us today is whether we want to insulate ratepayers of the Minnesota Power Service Territory to the tune of whatever federal funds can be leveraged, but also that we can minimize the rate impact by $25 million. And so that's actually what we're doing here, is doing our best to try, what Representative Lislegard is accidentally attempting to do, is lower the cost of electricity for when this project goes into effect. Is that a fair characterization that it would, not that Representative Lislegard was accidentally doing this, the part that...
Thank you. Nothing is accidental.
That this is actually, it's meant as a means for reducing the impact for ratepayers in the Minnesota Power Service Territory.
Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Garofalo. So first I'll just start out by saying absolutely. We feel the federal dollars that are coming... are becoming available for large infrastructure projects like that should come home to Minnesota. I do want to just clarify that the capability that we're building in with this additional design capability that we're asking for the appropriation directly for is actually to position all of Minnesota and the upper Midwest, you know, for a more efficient build out later. When you make these design decisions on these large infrastructure systems, you only have one shot, right, to get it right for 40 years. And so we're trying to position this with the most foresight and future-proof as we can. And so I would say that it's actually going to help the broader state and potentially even the region by positioning these federal dollars and state appropriation dollars now.
Mr. Chairman, if I could. Thank you. So, Ms. Pierce, my understanding of this project is that for the most part, absent the 2040 standard, this is a project that likely was going to be going forward. Just that the federal legislation and our timelines are sort of accelerating this project along, that it's not like we're doing this because of the 2040 bill that passed. Am I correct in that statement?
Ms. Pierce?
Chairman, Representative Garofalo, so I'd say partially.
Okay.
So first and foremost, this is an aging system. It's 1977 built. It's time. The switches and everything are tired. They're ready for a new technology. And so we have to make a decision now to either replace, retire, start over with this infrastructure. Our decision is that this is critical. We need this facility in Minnesota and connecting the grid together. That decision, that part has to be done now, regardless of what policy and regardless of what is happening in the world. We need to do that as stewards of the utility, as a utility for the system. The additional piece that we're looking at is looking beyond what can this system do. And so that additional increment to be ready, to be future ready for that additional increment up to 1500 and position it to be even larger in the future, that's the part that has really caught the attention of where we see the world going. So we see the world going where we need more transfer of energy in between all regions, north, south, east, west. And this is an opportunity to leverage basically existing infrastructure, existing technology to be ready for that. So it's a little bit of both, if that's helpful.
Yep. Sorry, okay. Mr. Chairman, as always, I know utilities, when they make decisions, it's not for one or two reasons. There's multiple reasons for
yep.
it. So regarding the level of interconnectedness, my last question will be, Mr. Chairman, that so this is outside the MISO's MVP process. Can you talk about why this is not MVP eligible or is that a conversation for a longer, different time?
Ms. Pierce.
Chairman, Representative Garofalo, I think that it's a very good question that you're asking. We do feel that the project to move the system from 900 to 1500 should be considered by the MISO grid as part of its broader regional planning, and we are in conversations with them about that as they're currently looking out to 2040 and beyond right now with their system planning. The base modernization upgrade is really about aging infrastructure we need to replace and keep the capabilities of the system intact for our customers and our states right now. So more to come on that. I'd welcome a conversation in the future about how this corridor and this line and this capability that we're enabling with federal and state funds could play a bigger role in the region.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Pearson. I do want to have a private conversation with you about Zach Martin's behavior as well.
Okay, all right.
But that's offline, though. We don't want to do that now.
Representative Holm.
Poor guy. Ooh, I don't want to follow that. Thank you. thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lislegard. My question is really, I mean, obviously, I am in support of this. I think we absolutely have to upgrade our grid, and transmission's a big part of that. My question is around the employment opportunities that this is going to create. You know, no offense to North Dakota, but I represent Minnesotans, and I want to make sure that Minnesotans are the ones getting those job opportunities. So I'm wondering if there's any guarantee or plans on how to divide those, you know, those good-paying union jobs.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Holland, excellent question, and we are actually very excited about the economic development aspect of this project for Minnesota, as you heard the testifiers mention. When we build this project, it will largely be in parallel. So there will be 150-plus jobs in Minnesota, and there will be 150-plus jobs happening as they build these mirror systems both in North Dakota and Minnesota. So we're very excited to say that, yes, Minnesota will see those jobs. It's not like we're going to do one and then ship them all over here and do another. It has to happen together, and so it brings a very exciting opportunity for the upper Midwest if you think about 300-plus jobs happening at the same time.
But could we do our side and then ship them over to North Dakota?
I don't know that that was a question. Okay. So. Yeah. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lissegard, for bringing this bill today. I guess my question would be, because when I'm kind of scared of timelines. I think Representative Lissegard, you're kind of scared of these too. We've been seeing them our whole lives. Are you foreseeing, Minnesota Power, are you foreseeing any issues with the permitting of getting these facilities ready to go so you can actually start getting construction done in this timeline? Or do you see any issues there? Or should we, as a legislature, be looking into permitting reform to make sure you can get it done on time?
Ms. Pierce.
Chairman, Representative Igo, thank you for that question. So, yes, energy infrastructure projects right now, all of them, have similar conversations happening around supply chain, permitting. How long is it going to take us? I think I've testified before this committee multiple times that it typically takes over 10 years to get a transmission line built, and in some cases longer. So it is a very long lead time industry, and that's why this infrastructure and getting started and taking these opportunities now are so important. Do I foresee permitting issues with this project? I would say there's a few things going for it. One, it is an existing project. It's an existing infrastructure, and so that's going to make the conversation with the Public Utilities Commission, which will have to do a certificate of need, you know, be around an existing system and optimizing, you know, infrastructure that's literally there, has, you know, the general framework already there. So that's helpful. Will we need additional permitting at the federal level? We likely will, with federal funding, and so all of those timelines will come into play. And so we would like this to go very efficiently. We appreciate all of the support of the Department of Commerce and the agencies to help us move these projects. Can we do better? Absolutely. We look forward to any ideas that this committee or others might have around permitting and working with our agencies. But we expect this to be a fairly efficient project because of its nature.
Thank you for that. And if I could just have one follow-up then, is there any concern with the dollars that we'll be leveraging from the federal government if we did run into a hiccup, and I hope we don't, is there any chance of losing those dollars? Because then the fear I would have is that those dollars we lose would go back to all of our ratepayers.
Ms. Pierce.
Chair, Representative Igo, if I understand your question, please correct me if I don't. You're wondering, can the federal government take back the dollars once they appropriate them to us?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, yeah, so the question would be is if the federal government, if, like, the project wasn't done within the timeline you presented when you got the dollars, if the federal government could reclaim those dollars back for the project not being completed.
Chairman, Representative Igo, that will be somewhat yet to be determined. I will say that the federal Department of Energy interaction that we've had so far has been very positive. We actually submitted a concept paper around this project and what it could do and why federal funding was appropriate under the Grid Resiliency Program. We got an acknowledgement back from the Department of Energy that this was a very strong project, and like I said, checking all the boxes that they're looking for. I would expect that during the process of federal funding appropriation, we will work with them carefully on the schedule, and if something has to move because of supply chain, because of permitting, that they will be working with us. They want to get transmission done as well, and they're very excited about the proximity of this transmission actually being maybe slightly less than 10 years. We're not sure quite yet.
Representative Igo?
Well, thank you for that. And those are just questions I wanted to have. Obviously, if you run into issues, please don't hesitate to reach out to anyone in this committee because we want to help with that. The last thing we want to do is see dollars have to return back to ratepayers at a time like at this. So just wanted that clarified. Thank you for your work.
Seeing no further member questions or comments, I'll turn it over to Representative Lissagard for any final comments.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I love the robust conversation today, and I appreciate the questions because the more questions we ask, the better understanding we have, the better decisions we can make. And this is a wonderful project that is going to lay the foundation for the next 40, 50 years. So I'm excited to be a part of it, and I would appreciate your support.
Okay, with that, HF 2011 is laid over for possible inclusion. So next we have HF 2009, which I think is also your bill, Representative Lissagard. So proceed and tell us about your bill.
Would you like to move?
Oh, wait, sorry. Yep.
Okay.
I will move that HF 2009 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lissagard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And this is a wonderful bill. Yeah, I like it. Big trucks and all that good stuff. So, well, thank you again for giving me this opportunity to present House File 2009. This bill is requesting $10 million of state investment to support a pilot project that allows mine trucks on the Iron Range to connect to an electric trolley system. Minnesota Power, which you just witnessed with Julie Pierce, is an incredible company that is forward-thinking and has a foundation that this state should be very, very proud of in how they approach things, their commitment to doing things the right way. And so this pilot project is a partnership with U.S. Steel, Komatsu, and Road Machinery and Supplies. The funds will be used to make equipment adjustments to the mine trucks. And if you've never seen a mine truck, I encourage you. I'd love to bring you up there. They are gigantic, and they move a lot of materials. These funds, like I said, will be used to adjust the mine trucks, install wire electric trolley system over the mine trucks, and build power station substations. The bill will also strengthen Minnesota Power's federal application for the Department of Energy funds, what we just discussed, for the IIJA to bring more federal dollars to Minnesota. And as an Iron Ranger, I can tell you anytime we can leverage money to bring outside money, that is exactly what we should do. And when we talked about the 2040 bill, I will tell you that, you know, obviously I had concerns, but when you look at the overall scope of where the state of Minnesota is going, this right here, I am so proud of Northeast Minnesota and the Iron Range. We're leading the way. You've heard us, you know, all talk about winning two world wars and leading in just in multiple ways, right? Well, now we're talking about taking this next generation and electrifying the mine trucks in Northeast Minnesota. We want clean steel. We want to do the right thing in this country. We need to make this investment in this project right now, because when you hear it, this is an exciting opportunity. When I had an opportunity to speak with Kevin, and Kevin texted me, and Kevin said in 10 years he's never seen a project like this. This morning it gave me goosebumps. It made me proud of the Iron Range. It made me proud to stand with companies from Northeast Minnesota that are committed to doing the right thing the right way and leading. I would just ask that you listen to this. You can ask all the good questions that you want, but please support this project. I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Hey, thank you, Representative Lissagard. We have several testifiers. First, I have David Shura. Please welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Kraft and members of the committee. My name is David Shura, and I'm the manager of Emerging Initiatives for Elite Minnesota Power. I'd like to thank Representative Lissagard for introducing this bill here today. There has been considerable focus in the state on policy to transition passenger vehicles and buildings to cleaner electric service. We are excited to be here today to talk about mine truck electrification and the potential for all of Minnesota to realize the benefits of electrification at an industrial scale through a demonstration project which this bill would help make possible. In the U.S. Steel scenario we have evaluated, electrifying just one mine truck with 100% carbon-free power provides reduced emissions that are equivalent to converting more than 500 typical passenger vehicles to electric. So to help put that into perspective, that would be the equivalent of increasing the number of EVs in the state of Minnesota by almost 15%, according to the most recent numbers published by the MPUC. Our evaluation of this demonstration project includes the following key findings. Diesel fuel consumption on the trolley line section is reduced over 95%. That's a reduction of over 1.4 million gallons of diesel annually. That also results in a decrease of more than 14,000 metric tons of CO2. This would be a significant reduction of emission and criteria pollutants in an area of the state where there are key Class 1 airsheds such as the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, Voyageurs National Park, and several MPCA-defined areas of environmental justice. Additionally, mine truck electrification has the ability to enable additional interruptible electric load, which can react quickly in response to the variable output from renewable generation, thus helping to further integrate renewable energy while keeping costs down for our customers. State and federal support is needed to help enable this demonstration project, to help offset some of the challenges the economics face, given lower price fuel and flatter haul grades in Minnesota than exist in other locations where trolley assist operations are in place today. Infrastructure and equipment needs that are needs include both new or modified electric drive trucks that have a pantograph on top that would raise up and connect to a trolley line, the trolley line itself including a power rectifier and substation, and service extension to the trolley line. Just as the state has helped incentivize residential and commercial electric vehicle service, this bill would leverage dollars from the DOE to achieve the benefits of electrification at an industrial scale. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I respectfully request your support of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we have Edward Falk. Please come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Kraft and committee members. My name is Ed Falk. I am a sales and business development manager for Komatsu Mining Corporation. Komatsu is a leading manufacturer of construction, mining, forestry, and industrial heavy equipment, and we are proud to serve the mining operations in northern Minnesota. We also have extensive experience with mine truck electrification through the implementation of trolley assist systems, and you may even have heard of some of those, like the ones that are operating at Copper Mountain in Canada and Boliden mining operations in Sweden and Finland. Komatsu is working diligently to support customer requests to provide equipment solutions that lower carbon emissions through technology development and power source flexibility in our haul truck design. Our product portfolio that is in development now includes haul trucks that can be powered by several options, including diesel engines, batteries, hydrogen fuel cells or hydrogen combustion engines, and potentially other methodologies that we don't know about or have not been developed yet. Regardless of the power source, our new trucks will have a trolley option and will be able to be converted to new technology as it is developed in the future through our power agnostic platform. Komatsu is committed to supporting customers' sustainability goals and responsible power consumption. Our trolley assist operations utilize electric drive mine trucks and a set of overhead power lines to supply power along an electrified portion of the truck's haul path, typically in an uphill fashion. This is where most diesel fuel is consumed. Trucks operating on a trolley line may burn up to 95% less diesel fuel and can see a significant improvement in the speed at which they operate on grade while connected to the trolley line. This increases the mine operator's production as well. Depending on the application, Komatsu haul trucks equipped with trolley can experience an overall reduction of 70% less diesel fuel being consumed. A pantograph is installed on the mine truck. It raises and lowers to connect the mine truck to the overhead power lines. When connected, electric power is utilized to power the truck's drive wheels. The truck's diesel engine is then powered down to idle until it is needed again when the truck departs the trolley system. In addition to pole-supported overhead power lines, the electrical trolley assist system components include voltage rectifiers, substations, and other connections to supply the appropriate voltage to the overhead lines and to evenly distribute power as needed along the overhead system. At Komatsu, we are building on a 30-year history of trolley innovation as part of our path to a zero-emissions future. Worldwide, Komatsu has sold over 250 electric drive trucks that are equipped with trolley assist and are currently engaged in inquiries for over 200 more. These opportunities exist throughout the world. This demonstration project would be the first trolley assist operation in a taconite mine in the United States and at the largest taconite mine in Minnesota. And it would be the first trolley assist operation that would be deployed in the United States. You can help, through your support of this legislation, you can help enable this transition and support the ongoing advancement of increasingly sustainable solutions for obtaining essential minerals. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Thank you. Next we have Kristen Bake. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for hearing our testimony today. My name is Kristen Vaki, like hockey with a V, and I am the Executive Director of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. For 30 years, the IMA has advocated for and supported the iron mining industry, including the mining operations and the many, many vendor and supplier businesses that service this vital industry. But iron mining on the Iron Range has been around for much longer than the Iron Mining Association. It's been almost 140 years since mining first began up north. Personally, four generations of my family have worked in the mines. In fact, it's what brought my family to the U.S. from Italy and Norway in search of a better life and more opportunity. And we found that in Chisholm, also known as the center of the universe. Generations and decades later, the iron mining industry is thriving. And that doesn't just happen. It's thriving because of the work those in the industry do to ensure it stays ahead of the time. We pivot and grow and change to make sure our operations remain competitive. This pilot project is a great example of that push for progress. Decarbonization improves Minnesota's global competitiveness of iron ore-based products, and this will significantly improve the efficiency of those big mine trucks that Representative Liz Lagarde was touting. This is going to keep our iron mines competitive, and when we stay competitive, it truly benefits all of us. This industry contributes $4 billion annually to the state of Minnesota. It contributes millions to public school students across the state. It supports nonprofits, it supports our communities, and it supports our incredible workforce. This is an opportunity to support the continued progress of iron mining as we work together toward an energy transition. Thank you for your time, and we hope we get your support.
Thank you, and apologize for not getting your name correct.
That's okay. It happens a lot.
Next, we have John Arbogast. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Attaboy. My name is John Arbogast. I'm District 11 staff rep with the United Steelworkers. I represent the members in northern Minnesota at five out of the six taconite mines. I am also a ex-MINTAC employee with over 25 years, and I am the co-chair of the Iron Ore Alliance, a very unique partnership between the United Steelworkers and U.S. Steel. Why it's unique? Because sometimes the steelworkers and United Steel do not see eye to eye, and we usually bump heads a little bit, but when it comes to things like legislation, environmental issues that we both can agree upon, we partner together, and this is one of those projects that can help the MINTAC mine. With the commitment by the steel companies to reduce their carbon footprint in northern Minnesota in mining, and also the steel mills that receive all the pellets from northern Minnesota, this is a project that will help reduce that carbon footprint. It's kind of exciting. When Minnesota Power and U.S. Steel approached me about supporting it, it was a little mind-boggling, but the fact that we'll be able to reduce the carbon footprint we need as we move towards the infrastructure bill and everything we're going to do and the cleaner economy. We need the mines in Minnesota. We need the steel mills that receive our pellets. We do not need illegally subsidized foreign dump steel from countries like China. We don't need our raw materials to come from other countries that mine these materials with child labor. So anything we can do to help these companies to reduce their carbon footprint, there's going to be no loss of jobs with this project. It's going to increase production. Our members like that. They'll be able to go faster up hills with their big trucks. They'll like that. So if something's good for U.S. Steel, it's good for the steel workers, and that's why we're behind this project. Thank you.
Thank you. Any members of the public wish to testify? Otherwise, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I think it should point out that this bill is an extraordinarily expensive way to reduce pollution. I think the perfect policy results in us lowering costs and lowering emissions. In the case of this, the items before us, we are going to be seeing minimal pollution mitigation at an extraordinary cost. And while Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, I know that we have unprecedented resources in the hands of the state of Minnesota, I would imagine that there are several other ways that we could be reducing pollution at a much more lower cost than the idea that's before us today. Thank you.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just this would be to any of the testifiers. Would this project happen whether you get this money or not?
Mr. Chura?
Mr. Chair, Representative David Chura with Minnesota Power. This project is a part of an application we plan to submit to the DOE as a part of their industrial decarbonization program, which they plan to issue a funding opportunity announcement for later this month. What they are looking for is projects that provide additionality, projects that otherwise wouldn't happen without the support of federal dollars. So this is an opportunity here to strengthen that federal application and to bring some of those dollars from the federal government, $10 million, to help make this project happen here.
Thank you. So it would be, if I'm familiar with the projects, it's $10 million of taxpayers' dollar money, and then it would be $10 million of the federal money. How much is coming from either you, the power supplier, to build this out, or from the company themselves,
Mr.
mining company?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. To your question, the total project right now that we anticipate in submitting a proposal to the DOE would be somewhere around the $25 million frame. And so you've got $10 million from the federal, $10 million from the state. The additional amount would be made up by private industry.
Representative Sinski?
Thank you. And so it would be $5 million from the companies themselves. And it's my understanding that they've expended approximately $1.5 million per truck. Is that the approximate that you have seen,
Mr. Chair?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, to modify an existing electric drive truck, it's approximately $1.1 to $1.5 million per truck to add the pantograph technology.
Representative,
thank you. Does the plan, thank you, Mr. Chair, does the plan purchase any new trucks from Komatsu, or are you simply just retrofitting all the diesel over electric trucks?
Mr. Chair,
Representative, the plan through our proposal here is to provide funding to help modify existing trucks, not to purchase new trucks.
Representative,
thank you. And then, you know, this bill, you know, as Representative Garofalo said, it is exceptionally expensive as far as bang for the buck. Not arguing whether or not it's necessary or not or whatnot, but just from a practical standpoint, I don't know, would the folks from Komatsu potentially be willing to come forward and speak again?
So, apology. What was the question?
Oh, yeah, I had got that part.
Okay.
I just was prefacing getting you here so I could get to that point. But, no, just from a technology standpoint, you know, it's being touted that this is a pilot project. approximately how many other mines currently have this technology in place globally?
Mr. Paul?
Well, as I mentioned before, we've sold over 30 years, we've sold over 250 trucks equipped with this technology. I would offer, you know, there, in the past there's been various reasons why you would or why you would not do add a trolley system. We've been able to do it for a long time. To the customers that, that produce these minerals, it, I would generally say it probably hasn't been financially prudent for them to utilize this technology. Fuel's readily available, generally clean, and not very expensive until it isn't. And so when we started selling trolley trucks, most of them went to Africa, where they had trouble sourcing clean diesel fuel at a reasonable cost, and they had plenty of electricity in through the mines that they had. So the difference as you look at this technology today is that customers today are being driven simply for the fact that trolley can take their operations, and I've talked to customers where, you know, 75% of their carbon emissions comes from the consumption of diesel fuel. And most of that is through their haulage fleet. And so these are, you know, massive ways to reduce their emissions shortly through reducing the amount of diesel fuel that they consume.
Representative, thank you. So just from a practical standpoint, so it's not that you've sold 300 trucks in total through Komatsu in these particular areas. It's 300 trucks that use particularly are designed around the idea of a trolley system.
That's correct. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just how many retrofits do you think you've had throughout your fleet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so this is a relatively new retrofit, I would say. So in the past, the old technology would be, you know, there might be a third party that develops it, or we're designing trucks now that are coming out of the factory to be trolley ready or trolley retrofittable. And so right now we're just getting to the point where those are being requested and asked for. So, but I would offer you that the current, we have quite a bit of inquiries into being able to upfit these trucks with the trolley system.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just a final question, just from a kind of a toolkit standpoint. One, how mobile is the trolley system? Obviously, it's a post in the ground, but is it in the ground? Does it sit on top so it can be moved readily as the mine shifts and advances in production? And then the second, what is the utilization with, you know, auto steer and some of the other technologies to keep it on track? That's it.
Thank you, Chair. Representative. So let me talk first about the utilization. Those are items that are coming that we'll have capability for those things in the future. Right now we don't have those yet, and we're developing other things too that help that technology engage a trolley system and disengage from the trolley system when something's not right on the system. We'll have that sensing technology and things like that. The other thing is we're working, you know, today to kind of develop some of the technology that will move forward with regards to, you know, charging and utilization of that power and where does it go in the truck. And then you had another part to your question.
Yes, thank you. Just being I farm for a living, and you know, we utilize auto steer and the rest, and the days are getting pretty darn close when it comes to the actuality of pushing a button and farming from your living room. And just, you know, how close and have you utilized those technologies within your trucking systems, and where do you see that going?
Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, we have developed that technology, and we've had an autonomous technology on mining haul trucks for, I think, roughly 15 years. However, one of the things that complicates it is when those trucks have to interact with each other, or worse yet, interact with vehicles that are not on the autonomous system. So we have those things in development. Those are things that will be possible in the future. But we do have trucks running autonomously now. But for now, all of our trucks on trolley are operated manually.
We go to Representative Altendorf, and we have some other stuff to do, like to make this final question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lisligard, again. I'm new, and so you're from the mining area, and my question to you is, you know, earlier in the legislative session, we had passed the unemployment, you know, to extend that for the miners up in that area. So my question to you is, what percentage do you think of the miners or mining is not operating right now in your this area? I think as taxpayers, you know, as we're investing such a big amount, $10 million, you know, we want to make sure we're investing and that, you know, we're going to be supporting that industry. So just my question is, what percentage, maybe someone else could answer. There's people here from different industries, but what percentage of the northern Minnesota, you know, miners are not working right now?
Mr. Chair, the other mining company had made an announcement that they're going to be calling those workers back, and so that is very exciting news. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, I think that's going to be kind of a progression moving forward. So I would hope very, very soon everyone that could be working, you know, will be doing it.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just, I mean, a final comment, you know, I really appreciated Representative Hollins bringing up earlier that, you know, we want to be supporting Minnesota and supporting jobs here and supporting the workforce here. And again, I mean, heaven forbid that coming from a business perspective, I want to make sure that we are investing in areas that is going to be, you know, a good booming economy. And that's what I want for northern Minnesota. So I would support this, but I also think we need to, on all ends, be supporting northern Minnesota and our miners. Thank you.
With that, I'll turn it over to Representative Lisligard for any final comments.
Well, thank you so much, and I would agree with you. I'm born and bred into that industry my whole life. So I did work at LTV, that was Erie Mining Company, that my grandfather helped build. Until I lost my job in 2001. So while many people talk about supporting mining, that is who I am, and I have always stood with my brothers and sisters in labor, and also the mining companies. If they're not successful, then labor doesn't have an opportunity to provide for their families, and our communities suffer. The Iron Range is like no other place. I don't know if you've ever been there and you went deep into our communities and you saw what we have, but it's not like other opportunities. Everything is connected to mining, right? Nobody would be in our schools. Nobody would be in our hospitals. Nobody would be on our main streets without mining, right? And I love to say this. We went from no cars to Mars. So technology is there, but do we have the will to make this investment to as we go through this transition? Talk is cheap at the legislature, right? And everybody's got their opinions in one way or another. But this is an opportunity right here for Minnesota to stand with moving a project forward that is going to enhance this industry and the Iron Range. I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Lisligard. With that, your bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we have Representative Smith, and I'll be turning over to Chair Aiken.
Let's see. Welcome to Committee, Representative Smith, and I will go ahead and move that House File 2032 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome. Would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yeah, thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'm going to be very brief because I know, like most committees, we are very short on time these days. So this bill number 2032 is about the Clean Energy Resource Teams, or CERTs for short. They work like a navigator, connecting people to resources, information. They need to advance energy efficiency, renewable energy products all around Minnesota. This is going, right now, they receive $500,000 per year from the CIP R&D fund, and this is going to give them an additional $500,000 from the general fund. That's what this bill will do. And I'm very excited as a Greater Minnesota representative that a lot of this money is going to go to staff full-time positions in each of the six Greater Minnesota regions that CERS has outlined, along with some other positions as well. I'm going to leave it there for now and pass it over to my testifiers.
Wonderful. Thank you to committee with the polish.
Polish, like shoe polish.
Polish. Hockey and shoe polish. Great. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Ikum, thanks for the opportunity to be here with you and committee members. My name is Lissa Polish, and I serve as the Clean Energy Resource Teams, or CERTS, director based at the University of Minnesota Extension's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. We've been told we have about 5 minutes, so I am going to move quickly. As you could see in the fact sheet that came in your packets, and you can see on the slide, CERTS is a partnership, and so we are not an organization, but rather bring together these four partners to work together on our shared mission to connect individuals and their communities to the resources that they need to both identify and implement community-based clean energy projects. We work across the state, and you can see our map of seven regions here, and have staff and steering committee members in each of these regions. In your packets, there was actually a listing of all of the steering committee members, so you can get a sense of the makeup of our steering committees. In our 2022 summary of impacts report, you see a sense of the work that we do, and with some of the written testimonials that were sent in, you also have another sense. We are looking for your support to be able to do even more. This gives you a quick snapshot of the different kinds of work that we do. And in the interest of time, I want to just quickly mention that this example on the right is a resource page from our website about the Inflation Reduction Act. This is emblematic of some of the work that we do with folks. We provide resources and tools to help them understand opportunities. We do direct technical assistance to help folks move projects forward. So we do projects with local governments, for example, to help them understand their energy efficiency options. We also then field direct questions from interested stakeholders, convene peer networks, and we do a whole lot of seed grants. Since we started doing seed grant funding in 2006, we have funded 467 projects that you can see here on this map. On the back of our summary 2022 highlights document, you can see a map of the 74 projects that were funded just last year, many very closely related to energy efficiency. And here's just a quick snapshot of some energy efficiency projects that we have done with food shelves and food banks, including one in Representative Smith's district, Channel One Food Bank, and one in St. Charles. This led to a number of other projects with food shelves where we are both assisting them with the work at the food shelf to make them more efficient and have more dollars to put back into their mission, and then also providing resources and tools like we are for Neighbors United in Granite Falls so that food shelf patrons can have access to energy efficiency.
Chair Ikum, committee members, my name is Diana McEwen, and I represent the Great Plains Institute, one of the four partners for CERTS. Grateful to be here to testify on our behalf. So this is, our work is really wide-ranging. It's always focused on clean energy deployment. This is kind of a snapshot of some of the things that we do. We have a clean energy job board, and we provide technical assistance to rural groceries, helping them get energy assessments and connections to get cooler upgrades. And this in particular one was Aaron's grocery in Fertile, Minnesota. We help host EV ride and drives. We conduct manufactured home park blitzes and overall really help try to reduce home energy burden. We have lots of resources, and we partner with the home energy, the manufactured home parks and their residents, and also with utilities on helping programming, including with Minnesota Energy Resources recently. Beyond manufactured homes, we have home energy guides for single-family homes, manufactured homes, renters, landlords, and they're in multiple languages. They are also customizable that communities can use them, or even a landlord could put their logo on it. We also have, you know, heat pumps are all the rage, and so we have oodles of resources when it comes to air source heat pumps. We have not only guides, but we actually recently launched a column called Ask Alexis. Our colleague Alexis does that column, advice column. And do a lot of work focused in greater Minnesota on renewable energy. We get lots of questions from farmers and small businesses, both on energy efficiency and renewable energy. Like I said, we help the rural groceries a lot, as I mentioned. We hosted two grant writing workshops for rural groceries to help them pursue some funding for the Good Food Access Fund and the USDA REAP funds. Beyond efficiency, we also do custom project assistance, helping people that really want to pursue renewable energy. Our Greater Minnesota Renewable Energy Program really helps explore projects that could work for farms or businesses, and we help identify funding, et cetera. Finally, we have done a lot of work with utilities and cities and helping them with preparing for vehicle electrification. We host cohorts to help support their decision making with information and resources. We do this across the state, and we convene also peer-to-peer networks, and we did one this fall for electric vehicles with a number of utilities and had a panel from that included East Central Electric, Wright Hennepin Electric, and Elk River Municipal Utilities. This is just an example of some of the work we do in Greater Minnesota on electric vehicles. We did an event in conjunction with utilities and car dealerships, and it included a big heavy lift from Minn Kota in northern Minnesota called Northern Exposure. And then I just want to say thank you so much for the opportunity to share more about CERTS. We've worked really hard over the past 20 years to help communities advance their own clean energy projects. And with additional support for the CERTS teams, we'll be able to scale up our work so that those communities can really capture all of the resources that are coming down the line right now. So and advance their projects. So thank you so much.
And thank you to both Ms. Polish and Mr. Kuhn for the brief but informative presentation on the great work that CERTS does. I think there's one other testifier that would like to present, Annette Rashan Piper.
Yes, Chair.
Okay.
Welcome Chair, to committee. Chair please. Acom and committee members, thank you. My name is Annette Kuiper, and I am the Community Relations and Beneficial Electrification Director for Wright Hennepin Cooperative Electric Association. Wright Hennepin is a member-owned not-for-profit electrical utility that provides power to over 58,000 electric accounts in rural Wright County and western Hennepin County. We find the CERTS resources valuable in our mission to provide clean, affordable, and reliable energy to our members. As a newly elected member to the CERTS Metro Steering Committee, I have witnessed their valuable work in connecting communities to renewable energy options. This has been shown directly in the Wright Hennepin service area in three ways. As you've heard today, the CERTS website has many resources that are accessible to our members, including the home energy guides and updates on clean energy incentives. Also, the CERTS team lends technical expertise and support to our efforts to leverage state and federal funding to build out our electric grid to accommodate the rapid growth of electric vehicles. Obtaining this funding will have savings that are direct to our members. Lastly, the CERTS team unites Wright Hennepin with partners to synchronize statewide clean energy efforts to provide affordable and reliable energy to our members. As Diana mentioned, they convened a peer-to-peer electric vehicle-focused webinar to share information with other utilities and to discuss auto dealer engagement. Our COO, Wendy Youngren, joined other experts across the state to share our EV initiatives and learn from each other. This additional funding will allow CERTS to increase staffing to ensure that the team is equipped to give us the necessary resources on clean energy initiatives that benefit all of our members in our service area. We encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
And looks like we have a question from Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think my question would be best directed at Ms. McEwen, who's the CERT director. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're getting seated there, I'll start going through the questions. So looking at all the stuff we got here in front of us, I noticed the one part here, you talk about all the learning opportunities you do in communities, which I think is a good thing. But something I think that's been missing in a lot of when we do learning opportunities for whether it be different programs, whether it be what's going on in our state, we forget to talk about the whole story of things. And I'm just wondering, in these learning opportunities, do you talk about what it means to, you know, how we get, you know, everything that is required for solar and wind infrastructure, how we build batteries, how we build cars? Because I think our society as a whole has forgotten, you know, there was senators from the range before me that talked about, you know, kids these days don't realize that milk comes from a cow, right? We need to be telling that story so we can be a more interconnected society to understand where things come from. So I guess my question to you are any of these learning opportunities talking about what it means to build an electric vehicle, to build a wind turbine, to build solar?
Ms. McEwen.
Chair Akam, Representative Igo, we provide information as broadly as needed for folks to feel like they have the information to make decisions based on their own community interest. And so, you know, if we're asked for that information, we do. There are several times that people want us to do broader, you know, 30,000 foot level, like what does the energy system look like? Where do things come from? You know, so we do those if we're asked by community to do that, for sure. We're not trying to hide any information. I mean, I think the important thing for maybe community members to know that don't know about us, we're not evangelists. We're not trying to convince people to do clean energy that don't want to. We are there to help them if they want to.
Representative Vigo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think it's a really important thing that, I'm not saying you're trying to hide anything at all. I just think that for us to be a connected society, I mean, we're always talking about how we want to bridge this greater Minnesota and metro divide and how we all can see things on a more global scale and work together on things. And I think that I would feel a lot more comfortable knowing, you know, if we're going to appropriate money for you to do out and do this training, that if we were going to tell the whole story of it, so that saying, yeah, you know, if you want to put solar panels in your backyard or at your community center, here's the process it's going through. Here's the way it's produced. Here's the way it's manufactured. Here's how you're going to buy it. And I think if more people understood the impacts of that, you know, maybe we could be the change and start investing in ourselves here so that we didn't have to tell the story of how bad it maybe is on the backside, and we could invest in ourselves right here in Minnesota. I think that's kind of been the theme of this conversation today, is how can we invest in the Minnesota workforce? How can we invest in Minnesota to be the leaders that we really are? So that's all. Thank you.
Representative Breen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to thank Representative Smith for bringing this bill forward. I did meet with the CERTS team, and I found the information fascinating. I know there's a lot of people who are really interested in transitioning. They want to know how to install a heat pump or replace their gas stoves or gas water heaters. And I think this is the connecting glue. Because people want to know how to do it, but they don't know how to do it. So I think it's great that we have a program like this, and I think it's a great idea to expand it. So I really appreciate this bill, and I fully support it. Thank you so much.
Representative Swazinski.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. Just, you know, obviously we're always concerned with kind of bang for your buck. And, you know, you look at, you know, I think, I don't remember quite where this is using general fund money for across the state, and other sources of income, probably from ratepayers, to fund this. Kind of what, you know, as a bang for your buck as far as an expansion, you know, like if it wasn't for CERTS teams, what, how many less projects would have been put in, do you think?
Ms. McEwen, do you want to take a step?
Chair Akam, Representative, I appreciate the question. I think it's hard to say that. I mean, we talked about the 467 projects that we have seed grant funding for since 2006, $1.6 million in that time that we've put back into communities. You know, I think that, you know, what we provide is something that communities can really grab onto and, you know, really do projects. And some of it's so intangible. It's really hard. It's about connecting them and making relationships with another community that's done a similar project that they learn from. You know, my colleague likes to say, we don't like people to make, we only want people to make new mistakes, right? And so we try to equip them with best practices and learnings from other communities to each other. And I'll say that, you know, especially in greater Minnesota, having additional capacity to help folks. We're getting inundated with requests to help understand the opportunities that are out there for communities, whether it's a city, a county, a business association. I mean, we're getting all kinds of questions and requests to speak and share information and help people right now. And so we really just want to be there to support that effort. We're just inundated with the requests right now. And I'll just say to Representative Igo's question about workforce and jobs, we have our Our most popular item on our website is our clean energy job board. It's pretty, take a look at it. It's got a lot of jobs on it. I think we put 30 solar jobs on it in the last, you know, couple days or whatever. So, you know, we are really looking at that workforce development, all of those things, and, you know, happy to continue that work and looking forward to that.
Representative Swazinski, did you have any follow-up? Seeing no further questions or comments, Representative Smith, did you want to do any closing comments?
Yeah, real quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for listening, and thank you for this great discussion. I would just say, as we're talking about bang for your buck, this is a great program for bang for your buck. Right now, we know their funding is at $500,000, and I think you mentioned $1.6 in local grant, million dollars in grants. That's a wonderful ROI, and so I would say let's put more money into that program and get even more out of that. And I'm really excited to bring this to you. I hope it is in the ultimate omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And with that, the bill is laid over. So we're going to transition now to a presentation that we have on Fortified from the Institute for Business and Home Safety. And just want to let folks know that we do have permission to go or approval to go a little bit late. And so we're going to stay and finish our business. It shouldn't be too far over, but just wanted to give people a quick little heads up. And Mr. Brickwitty, would you like to start?
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner from the Commerce Department. Just as we're getting the presentation pulled up. So the department has is bringing forward in the governor's budget a proposal called the Strengthen Minnesota Homes Program, which uses as an underlying part of the program a connection between the Fortified program, which you'll hear about from my colleagues from the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety in a moment. And so wanted to contextualize the science behind the program a little bit and talk a little bit about that and connect it to the rest of the commerce budget, which we will see coming forward to the committee in a couple of weeks. And connect and start to think about how the proposal that we're bringing forward, which is dealing with the exterior of a home and securing it against our severe weather here in the state, and also then thinking about how it connects to some of the interior work that we are able to do through programs like the weatherization program or the department's pre-weatherization proposal that's also coming forward in the governor's budget. So I will stop talking and hand it over to my colleagues, and Michael can take it away.
Thank you. Michael Newman, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Newman, and I am the General Counsel for the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, or IBHS. I'm joined by my colleague Fred Malik, who's the Managing Director of our Fortified program. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak with this committee about the vital importance of a resilient roof and providing quality homes for Minnesota homeowners. In the prior presentation, I heard Representative Leslegard in a different context use the phrase doing the right thing in the right way. And that's really what we believe when it comes to putting resilient roofs on homes. From our perspective, quality means characteristics like strength, stability, resilience, and reliability. Really, a home can't be quality unless it's capable of withstanding the effects of severe weather. And that's true across the value chain of homes, from affordable housing to the fanciest of mansions. So today we want to provide you with a blueprint of how to make homes the right way, doing the right thing for the right way. But before I get into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the weather here in Minnesota. You all are no stranger to weather extremes, which can include significant risks of severe convective storms. Over the last 20 years, you've averaged 52 tornadoes a year. Some of you probably remember the 2011 outbreak here in the northern suburbs of Minneapolis that caused a fatality, 48 injuries, and more than $170 million in property damage. You've also got straight-line winds. Just last year, there was a derecho that moved across the center of your state, bringing winds of 80 to 90 miles per hour and causing six tornadoes. And you experienced more than your share of damaging hailstorms. Just last year, Minnesota was the third state in the nation for the number of severe hail reports, behind only Texas and Nebraska. These trends are not going away. While year-to-year severe weather often exhibits variability, Minnesota has actually seen a slight increase in the number of tornadoes per year since the early 1990s. Along with this growing tornado threat, environments conducive to hailstorms have also had a moderate increase in the state, and that's consistent with what the climate models indicate as a general shift northward in hail-producing thunderstorms.
So what does this mean for the people of Minnesota? Far too often it means damaged roofs and water-damaged homes and belongings, with property owners struggling with financial loss. It means dislocated families who need to find other places to live while their homes are repaired. Following particularly bad days, it can mean disruption to whole communities in the both economic and social context. And I want to make this point really, really clear. That does not need to be the case. In fact, roofs can stay intact and homes can stay dry. People can come home after severe weather, pick up their yard, and move on with their lives. This damage and displacement and disruption that's too often associated with severe weather can be reduced and in some cases eliminated. You can help make this reality with the Strengthen Minnesota Homes program, and IBHS can help. So with that, I want to briefly introduce you to our organization. IBHS is a 501c3 nonprofit research and risk communications institute. We're funded by the Property Insurance's investment. We exist to help ensure that the places where people live, work, worship, gather are safe, stable, and as strong as the best science can equip them to be. We do it by delivering top-tier science and translating that into action so we can prevent avoidable suffering, strengthen our homes and businesses, inform the insurance industry, and support thriving communities. The core perils we study at our research center are wind, rain, hail, and wildfire. I want to show you a brief video that will actually take you inside of our research center, which is right here located on a 90-acre plot in Richburg, South Carolina. It features a six-story test chamber the size of an airplane hangar with more than 105 fans that are 6 feet in diameter, capable of generating 130-mile-per-hour winds. As I mentioned before, we study hail, and we've come up with new ways to generate hailstones. On wildfire, we're the only facility in the world able to test how embers interact with wind and the built environment. We study how water intrudes on roofs and openings and how to keep it out. And of course, we study the effects of wind on property, trying to avoid outcomes like this. We study in post-disaster context as well as the lab, and we study in commercial as well as residential structures. At full scale, we recreate severe weather so our scientists can see what fails first and understand what we can do to protect the investment of homeowners. And yet, we're never content with just pushing forward building science. We exist to take those findings and translate them into actions that are achievable, affordable, and effective. When it comes to high wind and hail that you see here in Minnesota, that's exactly what our Fortified program delivers. So with that, I want to turn things over to my colleague, Fred Malik, who can describe the ways that wind and hail damage roofs and homes and how our Fortified program mitigates this risk in ways that can really help Minnesota homeowners.
Welcome, Mr. Malik. Please introduce yourself to the committee or for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and distinguished members. My name is Fred Malik, and I am the Managing Director of Fortified at IBHS. I'd like to begin by describing for you the very predictable and repetitive regression of damage caused by high winds and wind-driven rain. This pattern has been observed for decades, over decades of research, both in and outside of the laboratory environment. In high winds, like severe convective storms and straight-line winds, damage always starts with the roof. Damage to the roof cover and around the perimeter of the roof can begin to occur at relatively low wind speeds, far below those that they are designed to withstand. Notice that we can recreate these same failures with remarkable accuracy in our research center. The next component to fail is the components to fail are wall cladding, like siding. As intensity and duration increase, roof sheathing and the roof structure begin to fail. And finally, if the winds find a pathway into the home, causing a phenomenon called internal pressurization, or it is able to push a home off its foundation, we can see catastrophic structural failures. In addition to these easily observable damage modes, I'd like to show you now an example of a damage amplifier. Damage amplifiers occur when a primary system like the roof cover is compromised. This can expose other parts of the home to conditions that result in significant financial loss and potential prolonged dislocation for the occupants. At our research facility, we conducted a demonstration to illustrate the impact of water intrusion resulting from a partially compromised shingle roof. We built a full-sized, fully furnished 1,300-square-foot duplex, identical in every respect except for one feature, what we call a sealed roof deck, which you can see on the left side in this image. Now, as you can see, the roof cover begins to come apart. The shingle failure starts at wind speeds around 60 miles an hour, well below the 110 miles an hour that shingles are generally rated for. You will notice that also immediately after the shingles begin to blow off, the code-approved underlayment, which is 15-pound felt, also tears, exposing the roof deck. With the wind continuing to blow and gusting up to near 80 miles an hour, we rotate the home to simulate the wind blowing from different angles. At the same time, 8 inches of rain per hour is hitting the home. What you'll see here shortly is on the unsealed side of the roof deck, 60% of the water begins to infiltrate the home. You can see it cascading down through the light fixtures, soaking the interior of the home, wetting the insulation. The water soaks these and saturates the soft goods and personal property inside. Roughly 20 minutes or so after the exterior damage starts, more than 7 bathtubs full of water, worth of water, entered the unsealed side, causing ceilings to collapse. There you go. I'll advance it up here rather quickly just to show that this is the kind of damage that happens when you have severe water intrusion. And by contrast, if you use the sealed roof deck technique, we can keep 95% of that water from ever entering the home, keeping the damage to the exterior where it can be easily managed and repaired. At the conclusion of the demonstration, claims adjusters calculated the value of the loss, as you can see, just by sealing the roof deck, which cost $500 in this case in material and labor, the value of the claim was reduced by 300%. It should also be noted that the $19,000 loss on the right side did not include alternate living expenses, or ALE, which an insurer may have to pay since that side of the structure was unoccupiable. A family living there would have been living somewhere else potentially for weeks. This disruption and the high cost of repairs is avoidable. Now let's turn our attention to how intentional resilience and mitigation can reduce avoidable loss at a community scale if we have a bunch of these houses in communities. If appropriate mitigation actions are taken to fortified homes in tornado-prone areas, we can narrow the path of damage caused by severe convective storms. Let's see. Technology is not our friend today. So what I'll ask you to understand then is that when you have a tornado, you have it rated forensically after the event has occurred, and it can be rated an EF5. Well, in that area where it's EF5, that high wind load is concentrated in a very small area. There are bands that extend out from around that in the EF0, EF1, and EF2 areas. The upgrades that we're proposing today that would be included in the grant program under discussion would essentially enable us to reduce or eliminate the damage in EF0, EF1, and EF2 bands in these storms, so effectively narrowing the path. So you might be asking yourself, what is fortified? So fortified is a voluntary set of standards that are beyond the current code. They are used to reduce risk. The Fortified Home Program also includes a third-party documentation and verification process. Fortified has two geographically appropriate standards, one for high winds and hail, and one for hurricanes. Each standard offers 3 levels of protection: roof, silver, and gold. Each of the levels builds on the lower levels, meaning that a fortified home can be achieved at any price point. Currently, there are nearly 50,000 families that are enjoying the peace of mind that comes from living under a fortified roof. Let's take a closer look at what it means to upgrade a roof to over a standard roof to be fortified. The first step is called nailing it down. That's securing the roof deck to the trusses and the rafters in a more robust way. Sealing it up, that requires a qualified sealed roof deck system, which we just demonstrated for you, to prevent water intrusion from coming in if the roof cover is damaged. Oops, and then locking it in. Locking it in focuses on the perimeter of the roof. That is where the highest pressures or the highest loads will be applied to the home, and it's where often the failures initiate. Finally, in our fortified roof program, we also do have guidance for installation of solar panels. So how do you install solar panels to maintain the integrity of your fortified roof, and how do you keep those panels in place so that they can be operational? These steps alone can significantly lower the potential damage for EF0 and EF1 storms. This level of fortified can be easily achieved when either building new or re-roofing existing inventory. The silver level designation includes additional roof, roof upgrades and incorporates a stronger garage door and roof bracing. These enhancements can provide protection from EF0 up to a weak EF2. Fortified silver can be achieved by both new and existing inventory. And finally, fortified gold is the highest level. This adds an engineered continuous load path. For those of you who may not be familiar with that term, that is a set of connections that connects the roof to the wall to the floor to the foundation. It absorbs the loads that are being applied to the home and gets them into the ground. This hardens homes against EF2 winds. This level of fortified is generally most easily achieved when building new. In addition to the standards, it's also important to inspect. You get what you inspect, not what you expect. A project is typically initiated by when a roofer or a homeowner reaches out to an evaluator. The roofer and the evaluator meet to discuss the project, the requirements, and the scheduled site visits for documentation. Once the roof is installed, all of the documentation is submitted to IBHS, where we conduct a formal audit of the project. Once the audit step is complete, we issue a fortified certificate, which is valid for 5 years. The fortified certificate must be renewed every 5 years following an inspection that is primarily focused on confirming the condition of the roof cover. The fortified certificate provides a simple way to understand what mitigation measures are present on a given home and confirms that a quality assurance review has been performed. As I conclude my remarks, I think an obvious question is, what's in it for the property owner? What do they get? Will they get less disruption and financial loss from high wind as well as hail events? They increase their attractiveness of their property to be insured, thus potentially increasing the availability for multiple carriers. And the property insurance affordability can be impacted by mitigating against risk, which can result in lower premiums. Let's talk about actual experience. It works in the lab, we know that. Does it actually work in the field? In 2020, Hurricane Sally came ashore in Mobile Bay, Alabama as a Category 2 hurricane, swept across 18,000 fortified homes, and in those cases, fewer than 1% of those homes reported any losses that related to the systems that were included in fortified. Those results were felt across the entire economic spectrum of property owners who had participated from multi-million dollar commercial projects to modest single-family homes in typically vulnerable communities. In short, fortified works. I'd like to pass it back over to Michael so he can talk about other public programs that are currently using fortified.
Go ahead, Mr. Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to highlight, there are grant programs that currently exist, much like the Strengthen Minnesota Homes program that's being proposed in Alabama, in states like North Carolina, South Carolina, and as of last year, Louisiana. These grant programs are powerful because they incentivize homeowners to invest in their own resilience. These type of financial nudges are really important when you're trying to get people to confront risk and mitigate it. It's also really valuable because it helps create a cohort of contractors and roofers who are trained in fortified and become familiar with it, and then bring those skills to customers outside the bounds of the grant program. In this way, government-funded grant programs can lay the groundwork for private market uptake of resilient construction practices. We've seen fortified contribute to disaster recovery efforts in Iowa, in Louisiana, and the Federal Home Loan Bank of Dallas is now incorporating fortified into its affordable housing initiatives. So I share all this because I want you to know, on the one hand, you'd be an excellent company in setting up a grant program in the state of Minnesota, but in the other, you'd be blazing a new trail as well. We don't currently see any other Midwest states that have a grant program like the one that's under consideration, nor do we see one in any cold weather states. So Minnesota would really be taking a leadership role nationwide in considering how to make homes more resilient for communities like this region. I want to commit that you have IBHS's partnership in making your program an absolute success should you choose to enact it. Thanks again for the opportunity to share with you today, and we look forward to answering any questions you might have.
Thank you to both Mr. Malik and Mr. Newman. I certainly had a chance to speak with these gentlemen today and heard a little bit more about their business, and was really excited to hear not only about kind of the single-family homes, but also multi-unit. I mean, there's a lot of applications that could be beneficial to all parts of our state and to all types of buildings within our state. So, I also think it's a wonderful way to layer on potentially other program on top of other programs that Commissioner Brickweedy brought up with pre-weatherization and weatherization. So, with that, any questions or comments from committee? Representative Holland.
Totally selfish question. Ice dams? How does this work? Tell me more.
Mr. Malik.
Madam Chair, Representative. So the concept of ice dams occur when water melts, flows underneath the snow that's accumulated on the roof, and then it backs up. And the way a roof is typically, I know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but when it forces its way back up, it's working up slope, so it's pushing the water up underneath the typical lap that is used to drain the water. So fortified, by sealing the roof deck, you are basically closing off the pathways that water has to get into the house. It doesn't matter whether it's from the rain falling from the sky or water accumulating underneath the snow. I think we have definitely an opportunity there.
That's a winning proposition. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Athena, Representative Collins, anytime you would like a bid, I'll be more than happy to come do it for you. I would ice and water your entire roof first.
Okay. It is one of the
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious, watching your presentation, how do you seal ridge cap?
Mr. Mecklen.
Sorry.
Malik.
All right, Madam Chair, Representative. So you don't necessarily need to seal the attic ventilation, particularly the ridge or the off-ridge vents. They are made. There are ridge vents and off-ridge vents that are made to a standard called TAS-100A, and what those feature is a dam inside. So when the wind drives the water up into the vent, it repels it. It pushes it back out of the vent, so it never makes it inside the house. So you don't necessarily have to seal it. You just have to buy the right product. And we have guidance on that in the standard.
Seeing no further comments, I want to thank all the testifiers for coming all this way to Minnesota today. Apologize for the little bit of snow that messed it up this morning, but thanks for being here. Appreciate what you've been doing, and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Larry now. There's a couple of things I'm going to do.
Chair Akam, you want to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to re-refer House File 1990 to the General Register.
Representative Akam moves House File 1990 be referred to the General Register. Tell us about your bill.
And just to be, upfront, this is a vehicle bill that we're going to put in the General Register for later use.
Madam Chair, I just, there's things that you could do potentially more creatively in this particular area. Like, if you're going to do this, you could have had, like, something to do with an actual vehicle in your bill. That would have been kind of funny.
Like donuts.
That would have been funny, but an opportunity lost, Madam Chair.
Agreed.
We have vehicles in the transportation.
So I'm going to end discussion there. Would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion to refer the electric vehicle bill to the General Register.
Representative renews her motion that House File 1990 be referred to the General Register. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the bill is re-referred. Chair Akam, you have another bill. Why don't you tell us about the HF 1991?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have another bill. House File 1991 is another electric vehicle bill that will be heading to the General Register, to Ways and Means. Excuse me.
So Representative Akam moves House File 1991 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing none, let's renew your motion.
My motion is renewed, yes.
Representative Ingram renews her motion that House Bill 1991 be referred to Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the bill is re-referred. With that, we are adjourned.
Sure. Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate your indulgence in this. I actually put it away here. Members, I just, and thank you. Do you want, well, you already have it, so can I have the staff or pages? Or they're not here. Maybe I'll pass it up. Okay, just pass it around. So, Madam Chair and members, and again, thank you again for letting me pass this out. We're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of an event that not a lot of people are familiar with. It's been described as the most serious domestic terrorism event involving our electric grid in the grid's history. And it's commonly referred to as the Metcalf incident. And I just included a copy of a Wall Street Journal article about it. Again, this was about 10 years ago. It involved California. If you, I know everyone's got a lot of reading material and a lot of pushes to digest new information, but it's something that I think is very important for anyone who's working in the energy field to understand in terms of the physical threat to our electric grid. And it's if you want to talk offline about it, it's can tell you a little bit more, not in the public domain, but if you read this, you can kind of read between the lines of what was going on and what happened. It's a truly fascinating and simultaneously terrifying story of what happened. And again, we're coming up on the 10-year anniversary of it. So, Madam Chair, thank you for letting me share this with members of the committee. I can't make people read it, but I'll just encourage everyone to take the time to take a few minutes to do it. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might add, it's on NPR, too. They did a good story about this. So I think we could probably look it up on NPR, and you'd find that same article. They did a whole show on it. Yeah. It's actually NPR, I guess I should clarify. National Public Radio. Thank you.
I'd rather watch a show on it than read about it, Pat.
Well, with that, thank you, Representative Garofalo, and this meeting is adjourned.